This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Neurothera from Claire Labs. Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimal performance. Neurothera is a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. Used daily, Neurothera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. For more information and to purchase Neurothera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk to an outstanding guest, a guest that we've featured before, because of his book, Wheat Belly. He's none other than Dr. William Davis, and he created quite a splash with Wheat Belly, and now he's back with a new book entitled Undoctored, Why Healthcare Has Failed You and How You Can Become Smarter Than Your Doctor. And Dr. Davis is a very entertaining writer. The book is a great read, and we're going to take a deep dive on that subject. Plus, we're going to talk a little bit about how the wheat belly concept has weathered withering attacks from people in mainstream nutrition, as well as the grain industry, who's taken him to task. So welcome back. It's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Davis.
Oh, glad to be back.
Okay. So, first of all, give us a little background, because you were a successful interventional cardiologist. 20 years ago, you were probably placing stents. And so this is quite a personal evolution for you. How did that come about?
Well, exactly right. I was putting in stents and doing atherectomies and all that fancy stuff in the cath lab. But the turning point for me was my mom died of sudden cardiac death just a few months after a successful two-vessel coronary angioplasty. So she died of the disease that I took care of morning, noon, and night. It got me thinking a lot more. We all know that heart disease is something that can occur very suddenly. People die suddenly at home. People have heart attacks. About half of them never make it to the ER. They don't survive. So heart disease is not something that's best taken care of as an urgent matter. It's best, ideally, we identify risk months, years, decades before anything bad happens. Well, the only device that does that with any kind of certainty, as you know, if I told you your total cholesterol is 220, do I know you have heart disease today and that you're going to have a heart attack in a year? Of course not.
How did you guess my total cholesterol? That's about what it is, actually. It's 200 and change, I think. It depends on the day. But
So obviously, cholesterol type numbers don't tell us anything about whether someone has heart disease, when it's going to happen. It's almost useless as a gauge of heart disease risk, nearly useless. Mm-hmm. One of the most useless things you can ever come across, yet, even though it's celebrated by big pharma, et cetera.
And excuse me, I think I may be a case in point, because in spite of that cholesterol that's just north of 200 usually, according to an EBT heart scan, I have zero plaque, and I'm athletic and, you know, generally well, I mean, knock wood. But all indications point to relatively low risk. And yet, if I plug my numbers into, you know, some of these algorithms, do you need to take a statin? It says emphatically, yes, I got to lower that cholesterol.
Well, you did the exact right thing. Get a heart scan. And as you point out, back then, this is 25 years ago, the device that did that was an EBT device, electron beam tomography device. It's now been replaced by multi-detector CT scanners. But nonetheless, these things just scan your heart for calcium, which is not an index of hard plaque, contrary to what a lot of people say. It's an index of total plaque, all of its components. And that's how you identify potential for heart disease. Normal is zero, of course, as you have, which means your cholesterol values are useless. They have no bearing on your health whatsoever. But this is a measure of disease. The heart scan's a measure of disease. And so I had literally thousands of people in Milwaukee, because this is going back over 20 years, and this was the only device in all of Wisconsin. We're scanning thousands of people, and people would come back with a score of not zero, but 500, 700, 900, 1,000. and which, of course, predicts heart disease right around the bend in months to years, depending on how high it is. And back then, they'd say, what do I do? I'd say back then, go and cut your fat, cut your saturated fat, mm-hmm. yep. go on a statin drug, a beta blocker, an aspirin, and exercise. They'd come back a year later. If we did nothing, the score goes up by 25% mm-hmm. per year.
Typically, yeah.
Uh-huh. If we put you on a statin drug, aspirin, etc., your score goes up 25% per year. It has no bearing. In fact, emerging data are suggesting that statins actually increase yep. the heart scan score.
And that's scary. Yeah.
And that's scary. So people are freaking out because there's heart scan scores. If you start at 700, now it's 920 or something like that. And of course, every time it goes up, your risk goes higher and higher and higher. So you're approaching 10, 15, 20% per year risk of dying or a heart attack. Of course, my colleagues, many of them, would say, well, let's do a preventive heart catheterization, put in some preventive stents mm-hmm. and maybe a preventive bypass operation, which, well, by the way, is all malpractice. There is no
that's what a plumber would do. I mean, you know, a plumber would say, well, you know, you're starting to get rust in your pipes. So, you know, we'll put in a new segment of pipes or we'll roto-rooter your pipeline. And, you know, and by that analogy, I mean, mechanistically, it makes sense, doesn't it?
It seems to, but as you and I know, there's just no scientific justification. People do not do any better. They, in fact, often do worse because you're subjecting them to needless procedures. But it pays very well.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of that going on even today. But anyway, we helped publish some of the data that showed that statin drugs, et cetera, have virtually no impact on the progression of coronary plaque. So what do you do with all these people who are very upset, you know, scared? Well, we had to start from scratch, and I devised, just by trial and error and reasoning it through, what would work. For instance, when we added vitamin D, it was the first time I saw heart scan scores plummet. Hmm. Not just a little bit, not just by 24% or 36%, but 48%, 56%, 64%. Heart scan scores actually dropped dramatically. But the thing that led down the whole wheat belly, now the undoctored message, is that the most common abnormality in the, not cholesterol, but the real test, lipoproteins, the most common abnormality is an excess of small LDL particles. These small LDL particles are very adherent to arteries. They are very inflammatory. They last about a week instead of just a day or two, like large LDL particles. Well, there's only two foods that cause formation of small LDL particles and thereby heart disease, grains and sugars. Mm-hmm. That's it. So I took grains and sugars out of the diet of my patients, and small LDL would drop to the floor, like drop from like 2,000 to zero or some other low number. But they came back and would say things like this. You didn't tell me I'd lose 47 pounds. Mm-hmm. You didn't tell me that my rheumatoid arthritis would go when I could stop my three drugs, including the IV drug I was taking. You didn't tell me that I would no longer be diabetic and could get off all my insulin, oral diabetes drugs and injections. You didn't tell me that my seborrheic psoriasis and eczema would go away, or my acid reflux would disappear within 5 days, or my IBS symptoms were gone within a week. In other words, people started telling me that their lives, their health, their weight was being transformed by removing the foods that all nutritional authorities say you must have in your diet.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I did a little checking before the interview today, and as of now, WebMD writes, you know, supposedly an authoritative source, quote, there is no scientific evidence that foods with gluten cause more weight gain than other foods. And I could quote you all kinds of other authorities, so-called authorities, that push back on the contention that grains are bad for you. They basically say that they're healthy whole grains. Or is that an oxymoron?
It is an oxymoron. So the people who say such things, let's put aside the people who work for the grain industry. Let's pretend these people are all impartial. What they fail to recognize is the flawed logic often used in nutritional thinking, and that is this. If you replace something bad with something less bad or less harmful, and there's an apparent benefit, in the logic of nutrition, a whole bunch of the less bad thing must therefore be good. Mm-hmm. So
Whole grain Cheerios, for example. Or
that's right.
Yeah.
I often use the analogy of cigarettes. What if I smoked full tar, unfiltered cigarettes? That's bad. and replaced it with filtered low tar cigarettes. And there's, let's pretend there's a little bit of an advantage, maybe a little bit less lung cancer, a little less heart disease. By the logic of nutrition, you and I should smoke a lot of low tar filtered cigarettes. Of course, that's absurd, but that's the logic used in the whole grains, data. That is, white flour products, bad, replaced with whole grains, less bad, and there's an apparent benefit. And that's true. There is less type 2 diabetes, less weight gain, less heart disease, less colon cancer. But there's not complete elimination of the contribution of grains to those conditions. So, for instance, one of the nurses' health studies, that's the big studies they use to prove that grains are good for you, the women who ate white flour gained 12 pounds. The women who ate whole grains gained only 11 pounds. Yet the conclusion was, and this is what the media shares, whole grains help you manage diet. No, white flour makes you fat. Whole grains make you slightly less fat. Same kind of logic over and over and over again applied to justify use of the inclusion of whole grains. So we have to turn to the studies that ask this. What happens when we remove grains? Well, that's where you start to see some really spectacular stuff.
Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. Here goes. Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimum performance. Excessive release of adrenaline and cortisol, plus environmental exposures and oxygenation, may be impacting your alertness, memory, and other vital functions. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. It's NeuroThera from Claire Labs. NeuroThera provides balanced neuronutrition. Used daily, NeuroThera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It promotes blood, oxygen, and glucose delivery to the brain and helps protect against oxidative stress and inflammation. NeuroThera provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. I believe in NeuroThera so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Brain Health Protocol. For more information and to purchase NeuroThera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to today's guest, Dr. William Davis. I think I read a recent study that suggests that while whole grains obviously weren't part of the diets of people maybe 50,000 years ago, humans started gathering whole grains even before they cultivated grains and put them in fields in the dawn of the era of agriculture, the agricultural revolution. They actually gathered grains and then they pounded them and baked them into some sort of paleo matzah, you know, kind of a flatbread. And that was introduced about 14,000 years ago, so they say, according to the latest finding, which actually pushes back the timeline on grain introduction. But is that enough time for the human body to evolve to handle the effects of grains?
No, there's a handful of genetic alterations that have been acquired by humans. So, for instance, one of the components of grains, modern and traditional, are phytates. And phytates act as pesticides. They cause the wheat plant to be resistant to fungi and molds and insects. So modern wheat has been enriched. It's been selected to be enriched in phytates. Well, phytates bind up all minerals in your diet. They bind up the magnesium, calcium, iron, zinc, and other positively charged minerals, and you poop them out. So one of the responses to that was a gene for hemochromatosis that appeared about 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's the gene, as you know, that causes hyperabsorption or increased absorption of iron. So it's a partial compensation for the deleterious effects of grains. There's a couple others, but that's about it. There's the vast majority of components of wheat and grains do not have a compensatory response in humans. So we deal with, so 14,000 years ago sounds like a long time, but it's less than 0.5% of the time humans have spent on this planet. So it's by far not enough time to have, you know, maybe in a couple hundred thousand years, we might adapt to the consumption of seeds of grasses. And by the way, I stress that. So wheat and related grains are really seeds of grasses. Mm-hmm. If we were all starving, our clan or our family, and we're wandering, hadn't eaten anything in 2 weeks, and you spy a field of wild-growing grass, I don't think we'd say, hallelujah, we finally eat and start salivating over the food we're going to make. Mm-hmm. It took some clever manipulations for humans to turn the seeds of grasses into food, but we did in desperate times.
It was a supplementary food in times of game shortages, at times where it was not the season for fresh fruits, and so the proto-vegetables that were smaller and more nutritious than our current crop of vegetables and fruits.
Beautiful. Yes, exactly right. When we didn't have enough liver, brains, heart, or meat to eat, or fat, or fish, or shellfish, or underground roots and tubers, or berries or nuts, we'd turn in desperation to anything. You know, as you know, in times of war, people will eat bark off mm-hmm. trees and grass on the ground.
A little known fact is that the term Adirondack, you know, the wonderful Parkland area of upstate New York, is actually named after a tribe. In the Indian language, bark eater is Adirondack.
So I didn't know that.
That's a little pearl that you can store for your next TED Talk or your next PBS okay. special. So great. What do you say to these folks who call for moderation? For example, Michael Pollan, who is well known for writing The Omnivore's Dilemma. You know, he's an omnivore. He calls for moderation. He says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. What say ye?
I say he's a great journalist who doesn't understand the science. And so people will say things like that. It tells me is they really don't understand what the science is all about. So when you have people who reverse their rheumatoid arthritis or their lupus or their type 2 diabetes or their acid reflux or their fibromyalgia with this lifestyle, it has nothing to do with gluten. So that's I should make that point. So there are many things in wheat and grains that are damaging to humans. There is gluten, but there's lots of other things, like wheat germ agglutinin. It sounds like gluten, but it's called agglutinin because when it contacts blood, it causes it to clot. And wheat germ agglutinin is completely impervious to human digestion. But in its path from mouth to toilet, it's very destructive. It's highly toxic to the intestinal lining. It blocks the release of bile for fat digestion. It blocks the release of pancreatic enzymes. A little bit gets into the bloodstream. You can actually measure antibodies in humans against this protein, wheat germ agglutinin. And when it gets into the bloodstream, it's highly toxic and inflammatory. The gliadin protein, a subcomponent of gluten, in people without celiac disease, it causes increased intestinal permeability and allows foreign things get through into the bloodstream, especially the byproducts of bacteria, such as lipopolysaccharide. There's a flood of lipopolysaccharide into the bloodstream when you consume grains, and that is very inflammatory. So on and on and on, many components. So to think that grains are only a vehicle for gluten and nothing else is like saying cigarettes are nothing more than nicotine, mm-hmm. A vehicle for nicotine, so low nicotine cigarettes must be healthy for you. That's the kind of simplistic thinking people like Michael Pollan is guilty of.
Well, you know, more and more through the efforts of individuals like you, along with luminaries like Dr. David Perlmutter, people have been eschewing the breadbasket. And has the grain industry been pushing back on wheat belly? Have you felt any palpable pressure to recant your views?
What they do is, as many industries do, they hire PR firms and then publish magazine articles, etc., saying things like the science
for hire and so on, journalists
exactly.
for hire.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? That only lasted a couple of years. And I think the reason why is, well, one, it's very difficult to defend that position if you come at the science in the proper way and don't use the poor logic of nutrition. But two, the gluten-free industry is also the grain industry to a mm-hmm. large degree.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're playing both sides. They're saying, okay, let these people bitch and moan about grains. We'll sell them gluten-free foods instead. So they're playing both sides of the game. And as you know, gluten-free foods are horrible. They're just plain horrible. They're different. The problems are different. But they do raise blood sugar sky high. They cause visceral fat expansion. They're extremely inflammatory. They disrupt bowel flora. So that's why people say, they think that wheat belly is gluten-free. Of course, it's not. It's a grain-free lifestyle. But people who turn to the gluten-free replacements, like breads or bagels or pasta made of cornstarch, rice flour, tapioca starch, or potato flour, you gain lots of weight. Mm-hmm. Your blood sugar goes up. You're cultivating diabetes, etc. Mm-hmm. So, but that's both sides of that game. Mm-hmm. Wheat and grains and gluten free are both largely the grain industry.
Yeah, it's sort of a gimmick. It's, you know, just like I remember when I was macrobiotic in the 70s, they started to introduce the macrobiotic treats, the macrobiotic candies, the macrobiotic desserts. And they were made with, they had the right constituents. You know, they were made from soy. They were made from natural ingredients. And the same thing with paleo snacks. You know, we now have a profusion of paleo snacks that are delicious. They're just like, you know, ordinary desserts, you know, paleo ice cream and et cetera. You know, I think there's a co-optation of many of these ideas because people just, you know, they just love their scrumptious food in whatever form.
Right.
So what's left? You know, obviously, if you inveigh against grain, you know, and, you know, I've seen your picture and you look like the picture of health. And there are many testimonials on your website from people who've transformed their lives with a wheat belly paradigm. But what's left? What can people eat? I mean, is it drab? Is it austere? can you implement that and survive and eat?
It's actually very easy, as you know. Eliminating grains.
Essentially, I follow this type of program, by the way. I'm on a paleo diet myself, and I've
so
really
you know
benefited
we,
from that. Yeah.
Yeah. We include lots of vegetables, some fruit, healthy oils like olive oil and lard and tallow, and meats and organ meats. We never limit fat. I urge everyone to never count calories. So there's actually plenty of foods. And once you remove grains and their gastrointestinal disruptive effects, food tastes better. Most people say that, you know, the goodies they used to think were tasting good, like a Mounds bar or some other snack in the past, are now sickeningly sweet. They can't even taste it anymore. It's horrible.
I find it. Yeah.
And people say, you know what? I didn't like Brussels sprouts until now. Now I love them. I make them with bacon, for instance, and it's just delicious. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happens, by the way, in kids. These kids who will only eat such things as macaroni and cheese, if you can break that habit and let them just eat real food, they start to ask you for chicken and broccoli and fish because their taste was so distorted. Now it's restored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even something like some shredded carrot on a salad tastes sweet to the tongue when your taste buds are more attuned to it. You know, it's we blast our taste buds with so many sensations, chemicalized flavors, lots of sugar, artificial spices, that our palates are jaded.
Absolutely. Exactly right.
Okay, well, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. I want to talk a little bit about undoctoring in part two. Why the title undoctoring? We're going to discover why today's guest, Dr. William Davis, wrote a second manifesto, Undoctored, Why Healthcare Has Failed You and How You Can Become Smarter Than Your Doctor. What's that all about? When we return, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.